The More Freedom Foundation podcast, brought to you by Robert Morris.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too great, man. I really am not a fan of dentistry. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I quite like my dentist. It was only £50 to get a tooth out. I'm sure yours wasn't too much more than that.
Yeah, I really like all of my dentists. The team of dentists that you have to deal with if you go 10 years without seeing a dentist. But no, I had some wisdom.
Oh,
I had some wisdom teeth out recently, Rory, and it cost me $6,000 actually.
Jiggerty creakerty, that's a lot of money.
yes. The evils of the U.S. healthcare system are really just beggar the imagination.
Do you not have any relatives in Canada and could nip over?
Conceivably. I may think about that more next time if I have more dental work that comes up. But yeah, it's
That's something that happens quite a lot here. If relatives that live down south will sometimes nip up north for certain treatments and then stay down south for other treatments. So just whatever suits them.
Sort of mix and match. I know there's some of that goes on, but you have to understand the U.S. healthcare system does this incredible job of convincing Americans that the services provided here are just better. And obviously, as we know, that there are many, many, many Americans that are way too savvy for that that bull honky. And get their services done in Mexico and Canada. But sadly, I am not.
Yeah, well, I know the drugs are a lot more reasonable, you know, the tablets and insulin and stuff like that.
Sadly, I am not among those smarter Americans. But I got to say, my experience with the past year of dental work has certainly made me more interested in being one of those smarter Americans. You know, I sort of apologize.
Are marrying a Canadian?
I should definitely look into that. I traditionally do okay with Australians. I don't know if that'll transfer to Canadians, but I should give it a try.
I don't know how their healthcare system is, but, well, the UK healthcare system is on its knees, and a lot of the nurses are going to Australia because they're desperate for people, so sadly that's where a lot are going. Well, they're getting paid well and respected, which I don't think the Conservatives want to do.
Mm.
I think they want to go down the American route.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's no question that I joke about it, but I'm actually kind of serious about it. If Britain gets the U.S. free trade agreement that they thought they were getting back in 2016, it'll probably include letting U.S. health insurance companies loose on Britain, which would be nightmarish.
Absolutely.
Yeah, is Northern Ireland technically Great Britain? And that's wrong. Or is that right?
No, Great Britain is Scotland, England, and Wales. So Northern Ireland would be what's called the UK. So if you ever look at a UK passport, it will say all of Northern Ireland and Great Britain. But don't worry, it's a very common mistake. And quite often people will refer to England as the UK. So it's got a lot of uniquenesses to it.
Yeah, well, get excited for your next tooth extraction to be in the thousands.
Are there any other countries with a deep link with America that have a lot of strange idiosyncrasies that you know of that you've maybe made a video about?
Yes. I think today I'd like to talk about something that is sort of an ongoing toothache for the More Freedom Foundation, and that would be Saudi Arabia, a country that I have complained about a lot on the channel and very lucratively, in fact. There's sort of two big bumps up in my channel's history. The first was talking about U.S. tax compliance in 2013. Surprisingly, that would be such a hit. It's a bit of a weird one, but it worked. And then in 2017, talking about Saudi Arabia, specifically doing a series called Everybody's Lying About Islam, talking a lot about Islamophobia and the whole concept of worldwide jihadism and how it was largely a creation of Saudi Arabia and U.S. national security sector. So yeah, I've been complaining about Saudi Arabia for quite some time and quite lucratively. And I feel like it makes sense to have a podcast episode dedicated to that specifically.
that very rational, sensible country, Saudi Arabia.
You know, it's interesting. It is getting more rational. I had somebody in the comments ask me, it's like, why are you so obsessed with Saudi Arabia? Why do you hate us so much? And it's like, I don't hate anybody. But yeah, I definitely have a fixation on Saudi Arabia. I think Saudi Arabian commenters are right to point that out. And the reason is 9/11. You know, I didn't like 9/11. Not a fan. But it's kind of interesting. It's rather a long time ago now. And MBS, the current leader of Saudi Arabia, was what? He was a teenager when 9/11 happened?
Yeah, he is very young. Is he in his 30s?
He's in his mid to late 30s, I believe. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the new leader of Saudi Arabia. So I think at a certain point, there does have to be kind of a statute of limitations on 9/11. Like, there's a lot in the, never forget in the United States, this, that, the, we'll never forget this terrible thing that happened. Well, I mean, honestly, the U.S. government never really did anything about 9/11. At this point, is never going to. And I don't know, I feel like I've kind of said my piece on Saudi Arabia, and I don't think it's going to last very much longer. Maybe I shouldn't be as focused on Saudi Arabia. I say, having just published another video talking about Saudi Arabia.
Well, they're always relevant. They're always in there. They're always funding tech startups.
It is interesting that the main benefactor of Saudi largesse has gone from Al-Qaeda to SoftBank. That is quite a ridiculous transition. You know, they went from funding the civil war in Algeria to funding WeWork and Adam Neumann. You know, it is quite a transition. And I do think, and this is important to emphasize, I do suspect that transition is to some extent real. I do think that there is a real move in Saudi Arabia away from jihadism, away from Wahhabism. The ideology at the heart of Saudi legitimation, the legitimation of the Saudi royal family from the 1920s until, say, 2016, 2017 or thereabouts, was this crazy radical Islamic fundamentalism. And because of how wealthy Saudi Arabia was, they were able to spread this throughout the Muslim world to the incredible detriment of everybody. But I do think that MBS has brought a real shift away from that. I don't know to what extent. It can absolutely be oversold. It's entirely possible that Saudi Arabia is still dumping a lot of money into funding jihadism all over the place. But I do think that sort of the centralization that Saudi Arabia is experiencing right now, centralization might be making it a lot less likely that Saudi Arabia is as much of a jihad funder as it used to be.
Do you think its failed invasion of Yemen has anything to do with it?
Well, I think there's so many resources have had to be consolidated. As I talked about in my most recent Saudi Arabia video, they're already trying really, 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 really hard to get ahead of the inevitable collapse of the Saudi system. They've been working, and then I tried to, in the video, the most recent video, give them some credit. They've honestly gone further than I've expected in the direction of economic consolidation. It's still nowhere near enough. It's not going to save them, but they have done a lot of hard work. And part of that hard work is consolidating the resources of the Saudi royal family, the Saudi economy more generally, in the hands of MBS. So I personally blame Saudi Arabia for 9/11. That might be a little bit unfair because...
Well, there is a lot of evidence to back that up. It's not just a tinfoil hat conspiracy theory.
It's maybe a little bit unfair because honestly, the CIA deserves a lot of credit for that as well. So I think, you know, I can't I can't demonize or hope for the end of the U.S. national security community or the U.S. intelligence community. It's A, you know, it's my country and I have loyalties to it, and B, it's never going to happen. So I do, it is probably a little unfair that I focus more on Saudi Arabia, which has honestly largely just been a tool of the U.S. national security community. To be clear, I would never suggest that 9/11 was like something that the U.S. national security community intended, but the U.S. national security absolutely maintained and created the systems and networks that carried out 9/11. That's just an established fact.
So a very tragic result of their consequences. It wasn't deliberate.
Yeah.
But if you fund enough incredibly scary ideological people, it has a habit of blowing up in your face.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, nominally for pretty good reasons, funding the war in Afghanistan that contributed to the fall of the Soviet Union. I think we talked about that a little bit last time. But what's interesting about that this question that's never going to be answered, which is to what extent was the Saudi government directly responsible for 9/11? SEAL Team 6 made sure we'll never find out, when they took out Osama bin Laden, which is obviously something worth celebrating. I was dancing in front of the White House for that. But upon reflection, that was also sort of the last chance to really find out how directly the Saudi government was responsible. But I think, I would be surprised if Crown Prince Abdullah at the time, he was the Crown Prince at the time, but I think he was in charge, directly said, yeah, screw it, let's go get him. I think it's much more likely that what happened in 2001 was actually a period of incredible tension between the Bush administration and Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government was outraged at the new Bush administration for their willingness to give Israel a blanker check than Bill Clinton had during the Second Intifada there. I didn't quite realize until I read Bruce Riedel's book, Kings and Presidents, just how bad the relationship was between Saudi Arabia in 2001, Saudi Arabia and the U.S. government, the Bush administration specifically in 2001. But it was really, really bad over the Israel-Palestine issue specifically. So what I would imagine is that Abdullah, got very angry and sort of it's a classic, Thomas Becket, will somebody rid me of this troublesome priest? Probably said a few things, was a little too angry and a little too many meetings, and other members of the Saudi royal family or the Saudi government sort of assumed that a 9/11 thing would be something worth supporting. But to even have something like that happen, what you need are a sort of diverse sets of rich people within Saudi Arabia. And I think that was also a key part of how the Saudis ended up funding the Islamic State or the precursors to the Islamic State in the Syrian civil war, was just a diverse range of Saudi figures, Saudi wealthy figures that can fund a whole range of nonprofits or this, that, things that sound like they're benign that aren't benign. It's like this galaxy of things. And what NBS is doing is shutting down that broader galaxy as part of Saudi Arabia's policy of just desperate scrambling to survive. NBS is cutting off a lot of the rest of the royal family at the knees. You might remember, I think was this November of 2017? He famously locked up most of the richest people in Saudi Arabia in a luxury hotel in Riyadh and reportedly started torturing some of them until they signed a lot of their assets over to MBS, specifically the Saudi government.
It reminds me of Vladimir Putin a bit. He did a similar thing with the oligarchs.
Yo, for sure.
I'm in charge. I think a few tried not to and they were quickly killed. So the rest went in line.
Absolutely. It is a tried and true authoritarian playbook. And that is what Saudi Arabia is trying to do. The virtue of Saudi Arabia has always been, from the U.S. perspective, has always been its incredible weakness, the whole point of Saudi Arabia was to have all of these oil resources controlled by the most easily controllable Arab actor. And the weird gerontocracy that Saudi Arabia maintained, obviously incredibly unjust that this Saudi royal family had all this power, but it was a Saudi royal family with very diverse power centers and weak and squabbling and this sort of thing. And that was great from the U.S. perspective, because just lots of things that we can control. In an attempt to guarantee the survival of the Saudi royal family, MBS is now taking more pages out of Putin's playbook. So I think the chances, there's a very long way of saying that the chances of sort of extracurricular, deniable, off on the margins, Saudi royal family or Saudi government actors or Saudi businessmen supporting another 9/11 seems dramatically diminished. So I don't know, maybe there's definitely, I'm sure that there's a lot of funding of mosques and whatnot that Saudi Arabia still does that is filled with a lot of vicious nonsense, the ideology that's being presented. But I think the actual...
Are they not trying to build like one of the largest buildings of worship? Is there not a giant mosque that has... it's got strange little things on it, like it has giant clock towers, but the clock towers are all the size of Big Ben, just for scale. Like, the scale of these things is outlandish.
Oh, I love that.
But yeah, you think there'll be more ridiculous vanity projects?
I think I know the building specifically that you're talking about. It's built in Mecca. It makes me sad. I really love tall buildings. That's one of my favorite things about being in New York City, is I just love mega tall buildings. I love to visit them. And it makes me sad that I'll never be able to visit the one in Mecca, which is one of the most extraordinary super tall architecture projects ever. I think it's in Mecca, and non-Muslims can't go to Mecca. It's absolutely, it's garish. It's nightmarish. I think they probably, as the Saudis love to do, the sort of ongoing project of cultural genocide against Islam that Saudi Arabia likes to commit, they probably like knocked down a whole bunch of shrines to the companions of the prophet or something, 1,500-year-old artifacts to build it. But I kind of love that building. I think it's just skyscrapers. I love big.
It's so over the top. It works.
Oh, it's extraordinary. Like so big skyscrapers by and large are, to build something that huge, you've got to be very simple and spare with your ornamentation. It's sort of glass and steel or what have you. But this tower, man, is it Jeddah Tower? No, I guess the Jeddah Tower.
It's called the Mecca Royal Clock Tower. Almost reminds me of Ceausescu's palace if you just went, keep going higher.
Yeah, very similar vibes. So most megatall buildings are these modernist glass and steel structures. What's so cool about this building is it looks like it was built in the 19th century. It's got like all kinds of ornamentation, but it's also one of the biggest buildings in human history.
It's almost, though, got a bit of Las Vegas about it.
100%. Yeah. Oh, sure. It's garish and overly ornamented.
I just love the little Big Ben reference, as if to say, you think Big Ben's big, when you see this? So the clock face is surrounded by these four little towers that are all Big Bens. So I don't know how this clock face must be half the size of a football pitch. Like, it is, the size is hard to comprehend. It looks like a render. It doesn't look real.
And, to fund goofy, I think actually that predates MBS, that project. But yeah, just to continue to do the things that Saudi Arabia does, it's in such dire straits now that it has to consolidate. And that's what MBS has been doing, has been consolidating the money. I mean, he's doing NEOM, so a whole bunch of other projects have to stop being funded.
Go on the back burner. I think a lot of NEOM is now going to exist in the metaverse, because of course it is.
For those who might not know, NEOM is this latest in the...
It's a city that's built in a line, and theoretically everything should be near you. It's very vertical. It's very like futurism from the turn of the late 19th century futurism. And they're like, yeah, let's just make it.
So NEOM is the latest and grandest in a long line of sort of...
mega projects?
Well, it's sort of vanity cities. I think every new Saudi king tries to build a new city. I think there was the King Abdullah Technical City or something like that. Is the sticks in my mind is the project for the last guy. And it's of course, when the new king comes in and starts his new city, the funding for the old city disappears. So I think King Abdullah Technical City exists, but it's less than 10% of what was promised. And Neom, I don't think Neom will end up being much of anything, honestly.
Well, it's to be 170 kilometers long.
Well, the line is a newer iteration. I think they've been talking about the line for the past 2 years or so. Neom has been supposedly something that's happening for about 5 or 6 years now. And yeah, it'll be, you know, I feel like Neom, the best prospect for Neom would be to perhaps get taken over by a different country. I don't know. Because it's such a strange project. It's sort of out where very few people actually live. And the few people that did actually live there have been kicked out by the building of Neom.
I think some have been killed.
Some have been killed, yes. It's a weird thing. Something that is, again, not actually going to happen. Now, that's one of the great tragedies of 2022 for Saudi Arabia, because it truly is kind of a last gasp for the oil and gas industry. As I was careful to emphasize in the video that I just uploaded a week or so back, I am not saying that this means that people are going to stop producing oil and gas. Not at all. I think people are going to be producing oil and gas on the territory of Saudi Arabia for the next century, because it's one of the cheapest places in the world to get it. But the 2022, I believe, will be remembered as one of the last great price pushes, last great price spikes. And for Saudi Arabia to be wasting that last real windfall on building a big trench out in the ass end of their country, it's just so profoundly tragic, and will be seen as such a historical waste.
But I feel oil and gas will end up similar to tobacco. You know, in certain places, it almost feels like nobody smokes anymore, but in some parts of the world, there's still, you know, huge demand for it. So although it's possibly past its high water mark, it'll still linger for a long time, oil and gas, because oil's just so useful.
I think that's a really great analogy. I think that's very on point.
And also, when you consider, even though I own an electric car, for instance, but it's full of plastics, which is all oil, the tires are made of oil, and roads themselves are a byproduct of the oil industry. So it's going to be very hard to completely do away with it. So it will be less exciting, less profitable, but it will still just tick over for a good 100 years or so.
Indeed, and I think that you could even fund a real welfare state or real investments in the territory of Saudi Arabia, but you're not going to be able to afford a Saudi royal family, which is honestly, I mean...
Yeah, you could do a Norway, not dune buggies in the desert.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to fund freaking Neom, that's for sure. It's not going to fund the Saudi royal family. And what's interesting is this is a process that's already happening. I made my first Saudi Arabia is finished video, gosh, 6 years ago now. And every couple of weeks, somebody will prop up in the comments and be like, you're totally wrong. And I'm like, well, actually, I said it would be done by 2030. So I still got some years to run. But also, this is definitely playing with the goalposts a little bit, but I you know, maybe 40% believe this. Saudi Arabia has already changed enough since I published that video in 2017 to kind of confirm what I was saying. To be clear, I do believe that the system as a whole will crash by 2030. That is my prediction. But to sort of special plead a little bit here, before I made that video, Saudi Arabia was still a gerontocracy with a succession plan that was supposed to go, I think, to yet another son of the country's founder, Ibn Saud. It was still a country with much more broadly powerful, with many more power centers within the Saudi royal family, with many more power centers among Saudi oligarchs. It's already gone through a pretty extraordinary transition. Mohammed bin Salman is, all the terrible things that have been said about Mohammed bin Salman are accurate, but also Saudi Arabia, you know, didn't necessarily want the crazy person they got, but Saudi Arabia really needed a crazy person. They needed some level of crazy disruption to survive where...
Well, you can have crazy and useless.
Yes.
So at least they got crazy and somewhat moving forward.
Exactly. And I think because MBS certainly has done a lot of malicious, evil things. The whole Yemen thing was his project. They try to ditch it a little bit because they're like, oh, well, you know, he didn't really become the full crown prince until, you know, there were multiple stages in his moving up the succession. And I think when his king came into power, he was initially going to be third or fourth in line, and then he became second in line, and then he became first in line. And they try to dodge his responsibility for Yemen because that started in 2015, and I don't think he firmly became the crown prince until 2017 or even later. But when he came in, he was as the defense minister, and Yemen was his baby. So yeah, Yemen is a horrible thing that he's done, kidnapping the Lebanese prime minister, trying to invade Qatar, just all kinds of insane stuff. Obviously the Khashoggi killing. But there are also things that have happened under his time in power that absolutely had to happen. To some degree, the abandonment of Wahhabism.
Do you think those early failures may have helped ground him? He isn't this superpower that can evade all his neighbors and do all these incredible things. He's sort of been reminded, you know, you're lucky to have what you've got, and it's best to manage your time here before everything goes wrong.
I'm sure he's learned. I'm sure he's learned from these incredible screw-ups. It hasn't made him less vicious towards dissenters. It hasn't made him... Well, I think he's less vicious towards dissenters overseas, that's for sure. Yeah, I don't think he's going to make...
He doesn't want the New York Times to get involved.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to make a Khashoggi mistake again.
So stick to his own people and nobody really seems to mind.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, my end game for Saudi Arabia is that MBS is going to fall first. There'll be some kind of very brief return of the gerontocracy, probably coupled with a return of religious extremism that's going to last about a week, or about a year maybe, before the Saudi royal family ends entirely. Like, MBS very much is the last chance for the Saudi royal system. And I think the reason that he's been able to consolidate as much power as he has is that I think most Saudi royals acknowledge that. I think they have a sense of just how screwed they are. Which makes it so frustrating that sense of how screwed
they
are.
So is he the sanest guy in the room? Is that the terrifying thought?
I wouldn't go that far. But I would say
that... But of the crop that could take that role, he must be the most sane, which is a worrying thought.
No, I think that's not exactly what I'm saying. I think there are a lot of people who would be much saner. I think MBN, Mohammed bin Nayef, was the guy who was the crown prince, who was pushed out. And I think I've heard a lot of nasty stories about what's happened to him. I think he's still alive, but he's certainly firmly out of power.
But it's very medieval.
Yeah.
What happens to princes trying to climb up the chain and become king?
Yeah, yeah. What has happened to him? I've heard a lot of nasty things. But MBN was definitely seen as much saner, much more well-liked in the United States, this, that, and the other thing. What I'm saying is not that other options were less sane. What I'm saying is that saner options would have been worse for Saudi Arabia. That's how desperate the situation is. So there were plenty of sane options. They could have, you know, King Salman could have handed it off. I think there's a couple, you know, they may not be capable of speech anymore, but there are probably a few sons of the initial founder of the country. So every king of Saudi Arabia down to today, this is including MBS's father, who's still nominally in charge, every king of Saudi Arabia has been a son of the country's founder back in the 1920s. I think there's, you could find grandsons, you could find many, many figures who would have been saner, calmer, less embarrassing stewards of Saudi power. But if they had remained in power and the old Saudi system had continued, God, Saudi Arabia might have already been gone. Because you needed somebody to come in there and consolidate power, as MBS has done. You need somebody to come in there and consolidate money, as MBS has done. You needed somebody to come in there and propose solutions, like somebody who was, you know, MBN was not going to come in and shut down the virtue police and introduce a sales tax. And, you know, it's funny. I really, really don't want to give people the impression that I am, to any extent, pro-MBS. I'm just saying that Saudi Arabia was and remains in desperate enough circumstances that they needed this level of disruption.
When Saudi Arabia starts to fall, what way do you think it'll happen? Will the Turks ride in and say, Ottoman Empire 2.0? Like, what way will it manifest, and who do you think will be the benefactors?
You know, there's all manner of scenarios. Don't sleep on the Hashemites. You know, I've always been kind of intrigued by the idea of the kings of Jordan coming back. I mean, traditionally, so what gives the Saudi country a lot of its legitimacy is their control of the two holy sites, Mecca and Medina. And if you read, I think even if you read Saudi Arabia's Wikipedia page, which is a little embarrassing for Wikipedia, but if you read Saudi publications, you know, they talk about, of course, our time-honored historic protection of, you know, for time immemorial, the Saudis have protected Mecca and Medina or what have you. That time immemorial is the 1920s, in fact. They did actually briefly take Mecca and Medina, I want to say, in the early 19th century, like 1808 sticks in my head for some reason, but briefly held it before the Ottomans and the Egyptians crushed them and kicked them out of it. But they have only held it securely since the 1920s. And the family that they dispossessed when they did it, the sheriffs of Mecca that had controlled the place, controlled the place under Ottoman dispensation or what have you. But I think the sheriffs of Mecca predated the Ottoman oversight of Mecca and Medina. So 800 years, maybe 600 years, something like that. That family that the Saudis dispossessed is the family that rules Jordan. So in more extreme visions, you know, you could imagine all of a sudden the Hashemites coming down and retaking Mecca and Medina, or then the Yemenis run off with Asir, Jazan, you know, the provinces in the south, and then Iraq or Iran. You know, I don't think that's particularly likely. I think that those sort of fantasies of division are kind of similar to what we were talking about last week, this idea that, oh, well, you know, these imperialist borders are bad, and if we just cut these things up and, make them match more logical lines, everything will be fine. And that tends to ignore, like, a century of history. I mean, Saudi Arabia in the 1920s, I haven't looked at this recently, but I think in the 1920s, there were like a million Saudis, maybe less. It was a tiny, tiny country, but it is now a large country of 35 million people that has been unified as it is with its current borders. So the country was founded in the 20s, and then I think they won a war with Yemen in the 1930s. So it's more or less had the territory it's had for coming up on a century now. And while I think it's interesting and fascinating to speculate about, well, Jordan's going to get Mecca and Yemen's going to get Asir Jazan, I don't think a split up of the territory of Saudi Arabia is likely or advisable. I think it would be horrific. I think that after Saudi Arabia, there should be a country called Arabia. I think that is...
That might be democratic?
Oh, not anytime soon. I think that it'll go through a similar cycle to Iran, I would imagine. I go back and forth on that. I just don't know how The interesting thing about MBS is that he is very popular. And he has been, interestingly, this is, it's not, I mean, he has been an incredible force for Westernization and modernization of Saudi Arabia. I mean, these are the figures who do that are often quite authoritarian. Ataturk in Turkey was single-handedly secularized that country and put it on a more Western-focused path, you know, changing the script, you know, even down to the letters that went from Arabic letters to Roman-style letters in the language itself. And he was quite an authoritarian. And MBS is, gosh, man, comparing MBS to Ataturk, I apologize to all my Turkish listeners, it's not intentional. But he is an extraordinary force for Westernization, you know, allowing women to participate in society in meaningful ways, allowing concerts and films. And this has allowed him to attain a high degree of popularity. That's the official story. I think there is some truth to the official story. But are there significant populations of young people in Saudi Arabia? I know there are significant populations of old people in Saudi Arabia, but are there also young people who believe that he's gone too far, that he's betraying Saudi Arabia? I just don't know. And for my initial assumption is that, so first, when Saudi Arabia falls, my assumption is that MBS, eventually there'll be a combination of low oil price and enough of his tech investments blowing up, that MBS will finally lose control. And when MBS loses control, the Saudi royal family, some of those boring, sane people, will find themselves reinstalled, and probably there'll be a bunch of U.S. military-industrial complex figures are like, oh, thank God, the good old Saudis are back. And they'll last like 6 months to a year because they'll be dealing with the exact, you know, it's sort of like Kais Saied in Tunisia, who's like, oh, I'm going to solve everything by coming in and being here, and the economic problems haven't changed at all. So I expect the first stage in Saudi's fall is MBS eventually being kicked out or killed or this, that, and the other thing, an attempt to revert back to the old system that won't last very long at all, and then question mark. I think it's probably likely, considering, you know, Saudi Arabia is finally going to get the nightmare that they've imposed on a Muslim country after Muslim country. For the past half century.
Do you think there's a lot of hatred for them by their neighbors because of what they've done to them?
Oh, absolutely. No question. The governments...
Like, they would really relish the fall of Saudi Arabia and do their best to speed it up?
I think the world would relish the fall of Saudi Arabia, but nobody in the world would relish the fall of Saudi Arabia more than the Arabs and just the abuse that they've had to face. So I think what's going to happen, I'm not saying what's going to happen, because who knows? Like, I mean, if MBS hangs on, he's hung on for 5 years, if he hangs on for a whole decade, like, are we going to get to a point of like irreversible change where there is enough of a constituency of young Saudi Arabians who have gotten to like?
Because it is a very young population. I think it's about... 50% of the population is under 25, which is incredibly high.
So I don't know. Like, maybe he's actually going to manage to change enough of Saudi Arabia that, like...
And maybe we'll all move to the line.
I find that unlikely. But maybe he's going to change enough of Saudi Arabia that the prospect of a caliphate or some kind of extreme Muslim state after him isn't going to happen. But for years, I've assumed that the most likely post-MBS thing, post-Saudi royal family thing, is a sort of Taliban or Iranian-style government. That's what I've thought has been the most likely. I'm beginning to question that. You know, so finally, Saudi Arabia gets a taste of its own medicine, what it's been imposing on places like Afghanistan and Algeria and other places for so long. It actually comes home. And they get some kind of, you know, Syria, Iraq, some kind of diluted crazy jihadist. But I feel like also just like the stock of crazy jihadism, I think, has been falling everywhere since the Islamic State. I mean, it's just kind of, I think we talked last week about how you know, anarchism at the turn of the 19th, 20th centuries just sort of burned itself out because it was so stupid. I feel like that maybe that sort of caliphate approach has as well. I just don't know. But I would assume
it's also, as you say, it's an incredibly expensive and large regime to fund. It's definitely feels like once things go down, they'll go down quick. I can't see a lot of these, you know, the higher echelons of Saudi Arabian society surviving. When things go wrong, they seemed like they were far too pampered and looked after to really cope with any big shocks.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Like there's doubt in my mind whether or not what comes after the Saudis is going to be a extreme Muslim government. There is no doubt in my mind that the Saudis are going to fall, and they're going to fall hard. The Saudi royal family, specifically. But you know, I mean, who knows?
Can you see the leaders heading over to Florida for medical treatment while their supporters ransack the parliamentary buildings?
Well, I think the rich Saudi royals will end up, absolutely. I think the wealthy Saudi royals, MBS or his survivors, will end up on the French Riviera. There was some place that was surprising where MBS was building a compound. I think MBS is building a compound in Montana, maybe something like that. So sort of Montana or the French Riviera for the rich ones and driving cabs in the Washington, D.C. suburbs for the poor ones. And part of MBS's whole governing approach is to make his faction of the Saudi royal family wealthy and the others poorer. That strikes me as the most likely future for the Saudi royal family, the French Riviera and driving cabs in Washington, D.C.
So instead of them killing themselves, it could be their neighbors doing it for them?
You know, hard to say. Hard to say. I don't think the division of, so a lot depends on how the United States handles this. Are we going to, you know, go to bat for, to what extent are the United States and Pakistan going to go to bat for the Saudi royal family? I think really interesting questions. You know, you could have, you know, if the U.S. sends in special forces teams, could you have like a Saudi royal family controlling Riyadh for a number of years? If we went in that direction, then yeah, like it does look a little more possible that, you know, the Jordanians will take Mecca and Medina, and the Yemenis will take Asir and Jizan. If the United States, and well, Pakistan also, I just ran a short recently talking about how Saudi Arabia supports Pakistan a lot because Saudi Arabia would like to use the Pakistani military. So I think a lot depends on if outside actors have the good sense to let the Saudis go. I mean, I think there's something to be said for loyalty or what have you. The Saudi royal family should be welcomed to those cab driving jobs in suburban Washington, D.C.
That would be surreal.
Yeah, that's as far as my loyalty goes. I think it would be an incredible mistake for the U.S. military or the Pakistani military to maintain some, you know, Yemen-style rump Saudi royal government in Riyadh for a number of years, because that actually could lead to the disintegration of Saudi Arabia. I think far better to just let them fall and let whatever emerges afterwards emerge. I think we've proved repeatedly over and over and over again over the past 20 years that the United States is no good at saving governments or setting up governments.
So NATO won't be rocking in to save the day?
That'd be very stupid. I don't think we're really capable of it. But I know we're capable of making things much, much worse. But I think that's a really important question. I hadn't really thought about that, Rory, but I think that's entirely on point.
How will this affect Palestine?
Well, it's funny to remember that just 20 years ago, it's entirely possible, I think likely, in fact, that the elements in Saudi Arabia, well, it's a fact that Saudi actors, the Saudi terrorists themselves, but I think it's also plausible that more serious elements of the Saudi government carried out 9/11 in a reaction to the Bush administration's perceived cruelty to Palestinians during the Second Intifada. It's crazy to remember that just 20 years ago, that's where politics were. Whereas today, MBS is seen as one of the firmest friends of Israel available. Part of that crushing of support for, and I would never characterize support for Palestine as support for terrorism, but the truth is that that diversity of power centers that I was talking about in the Saudi royal family and in the Saudi business oligarch community, that diversity also included a lot of funding and probably a lot of funding streams for, you know, frickin' Twitter, for U.S. businesses, you know, Talawid, but also funding streams for, you know, a variety of NGOs, some of them terrorists, some of them environmental, I don't know, and some of them Palestinian. So that consolidation of Saudi power and crushing of other sources of Saudi funding has meant less for the Palestinians. Of course, I'm sure the Gulf, because they have to, are still big funders. You know, their publics require them to still be big funders for the Palestinian cause more generally. But it is kind of fascinating that, and I think this is one of many factors that is going to lead to the collapse of the Saudi royal family, is that any savvy observer of Middle Eastern politics now sees the Saudi royal family as more closely aligned to Israel than they are to the Palestinians, which is just gobsmacking to think of what an incredible change that has, that is, that represents just over, I mean, honestly, just over the past 5 or 6 years. King Abdullah, who had died in 2015, was a firm advocate and supporter of Palestine and enemy of Israel. And MBS seems to be the opposite. So MBS is, you know, would of course be horrified to be described as an enemy of Palestine, but he would be less horrified to be described as a firm friend of Israel, I think. Well, in certain contexts.
He knows what side his bread's buttered on.
I think that's one way. He's a fellow subsidiary of the U.S. military industrial complex, yes. Yeah, so that will be kind of fascinating. I made a video a couple of years back just talking about different generations of Arab attempts at independence and legitimation, and how Nasserism, the sort of old school nationalist, socialist leaning, you know, pro-modernization bent of pan-Arabism, probably the last great exemplar of that would be Saddam Hussein. That sort of vein of Arab leadership died out because of failure, specifically failure against Israel. And the next option was the kind of radical jihadism represented by Saudi Arabia. And I think any sane observer of the region over the past 20 years, Arab or otherwise, has got to say that, oh, wow, I guess this whole radical Islam thing kind of failed even worse than Nasser did. Because, you know, at least we're at the end of the wave of pan-Arab nationalism, like, there were more independent Arab countries, whereas all that radical jihadism has yielded over the past 20 years is Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and other countries being outright dismembered, and the rest of the Arab countries being put in a position of subservience that would be appalling to most Arab leadership in the first decades of independence, you know, during the Cold War. So I think clearing away the mess of the Saudi royal family is definitely a crucial step in Arabs figuring out what's next. So, yeah.
So you're going to give them another month?
No, I think by 2030. What was honestly surprising to me is I didn't realize this. So every 3 or 4 years or so, I make, or two or three, depends, I make a video where I talk about the oil market in some detail. And what's interesting is that the graphs don't work from year to year. I have to redraw all the graph lines because the numbers change because the value of the U.S. dollar changes. So when I do a video with a graph of oil prices, it's in the year. So the graph for that video from a couple weeks back is in 2023 dollars. So that means that, you know, while I remember in 2014 or thereabouts, oil prices were around $100 a barrel.
In 2023 dollars, they were around $120 a barrel. And that was just normal pricing. So I just hadn't done that math. And I hadn't quite realized, you know, I'd been saying all year, well, you have to understand these prices are high, but the prices were actually much higher back in 2008. The biggest, you know, before the financial crisis, China was growing gangbusters, and that was sort of the previous very high point of oil and gas prices. And 2022's price explosion got nowhere near that. What I didn't realize until I did this video a couple weeks back was actually the big price spike in 2022 didn't get close or was about where prices were normally in 2014. I didn't realize just how, you know, the way that the value of the dollar shifts. I didn't realize that $120 a barrel of oil, which sounds crazy high, is actually what was normal back in the 2000s and up until 2014. So even with what's supposedly this incredible windfall, incredible year, miraculous year for Saudi Arabia, it's actually, the prices actually haven't been that high, and they're going to go lower. I think it's entirely possible that something will go wrong in Russia or Ukraine, or we'll get a war with Iran or something that will make prices spike again this year or the next year. But that is not something that's going to be sustained across the 2030s. I mean, just think of it. Russia has become an international pariah.
In less than a year?
Yeah, well, we've had attempts to put a cap on Russian oil and gas prices. Europe now buys more gas from the United States than it does from Russia. A year of just extraordinary disruption. And yes, it's true, Russian oil and gas has continued to flow at higher volumes than one would have expected. But even with all that, like just this extraordinary level of insane disruption, and the oil prices are still lower than they were in, sorry, the oil prices are still lower than they were a year ago. It's insane. And if all of this can go wrong and only give us this minor boost to the finances of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf countries, then the future is grim. I'd say 2022 actually made me...
Does Saudi Arabia do anything else other than oil?
Oh, they do. Well, the key, I think the second biggest thing other than oil and gas, and I think they're much more focused on oil than gas, which makes them as distinct from Qatar and the UAE. They have more gas resources that they could develop, is my understanding. The biggest economic factor other than oil and gas is the Hajj or Umrah and the Hajj. It's a pilgrimage to Mecca. And I did the math on this years ago, which in a different environment for prices and whatnot. But I did the math on it, and it was something like, I think the Hajj all told, I know, so the Hajj is like the actual time of the year you're supposed to make the pilgrimage to Mecca. And then the Umrah, I think, is if you go on a different period of time. I could be wrong about that. But that whole tourism, religious tourism part, amounted to something like 5 to 10% of the amount of money they get from petroleum. So it's important. It's
that's incredible.
It's incredible. It's an incredible amount of money if you think about how much money Saudi Aramco makes. But it's not something that's going to be able to save Saudi Arabia in the context of lower for longer oil prices. And other than that, yeah, I mean they're now trying. And yeah, I'd say they've got further in this direction than I would have expected in 2017. They're trying to set Saudi Arabia up as sort of like a Dubai or something along those lines, where like, oh, there's travel and there's tourism and things you can do here, which is an extraordinary shift. I mean, and I think NEOM is meant to be under an even broader, the religious police that would go around, you know, beating women who are inappropriately dressed has been neutered throughout Saudi Arabia, but there should be significantly broader rules for NEOM or what have you. But the thing is, that's just like sort of a limited, that's actually a very limited market of just sort of degenerate British bankers who want to live overseas. You know, if they're going to live in NEOM, that means they're not going to live in Doha and Dubai and that, or Abu Dhabi. And that's actually going to create tensions within the GCC. And the degenerate British bankers, tax dodgers across the Western world that have made Dubai into what it is, that's not enough. That's enough to, according to some, provide a viable alternative economy for the United Arab Emirates, which is a much, much, much smaller country than Saudi Arabia, with much, much, much smaller duties and responsibilities than a population of 35 million or a royal family of thousands, which is what Saudi Arabia has. So yeah, I don't think there's much of a chance for Saudi Arabia to diversify their way out of it. But I do, you know, I do think that I should be, I think I've tried in this podcast to be less negative about Saudi Arabia. Like at a certain point, I've said my piece. It's pretty well established that Saudi Arabia is among the most responsible actors for 9/11. But if the U.S. government didn't choose to do anything about it, who am I to maintain, this vendetta? I've said my piece. I wish the Arabian people the best, and I even wish the Saudi royal family a lucrative future of driving cabs in suburban Washington, D.C.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.